just two notes on that. The rest of those solos just sound so tame after Dolphy's. But also, that was 1961. It's crazy to think how much further along and far out jazz was compared to rock music, which was going to take another couple of years to really catch up. This has been Experiment with Time on WRCT Pittsburgh. Check out the full playlist up on WRCT.org and enjoy the rest of your night, folks.
This is my voice. It can tell you a lot about me, and I'm not changing it for anyone. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of NPR episodes centered on the Black experience. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get podcasts.
From KUT and KUTX Studios.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
It is important as mayors that we maintain and even enhance our connection to the people that we serve. We have to become our best communicators. And what I have learned over the last 8 years as mayor is that I have to be out there talking directly to the people. I have to be amongst them and tell what we are doing, listen to them, be accessible to them, and then hope that they too become your ambassadors. And so when they are seeing or reading stories, they themselves can say, that's not true.
Mayor Sylvester Turner of Houston, Texas. This past summer, the city of Houston played host to the National Urban League Annual Conference. The conference brought together major leaders from the business, government, and social advocacy sectors and served as a center for policymakers, political activists, and others to meet and exchange ideas, network, and develop strategies to address a broad range of issues. The National Urban League is a historic civil rights organization dedicated to economic empowerment in order to elevate the standard of living in historically underserved urban communities. The organization spearheads the efforts of its 92 local affiliates through the development of program, public policy, research, and advocacy, providing direct services that impact and improve the lives of more than 2 million people annually nationwide. I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, the African-American mayors of the nation's four largest cities in Black America.
Well, you know, following up on what you were saying, I believe that in our communities, we've worked for years and know the strategies to intervene and prevent crime. There's always the rap that Black folks are upset if it's a law enforcement involved death, but say nothing when it's Black on Black, which I reject that notion. That is not true. But unfortunately, the grassroots work that happens in all of our communities is never lifted up, and we need to invest more in that. When we went through the time period of mass incarceration, which is not like it's over, but it's a little bit different now, you know, laws were passed to lock us up for everything under the sun, including what I believe were health, social, and economic issues that should not have required incarceration.
Mayor Karen Bass of Los Angeles, California. The first two African-American mayors were elected in 1868, the year the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution was adopted. However, it would take another 100 years for an African-American to be elected mayor of a large U.S. city. In 1970, Newark, New Jersey, and Dayton, Ohio, both elected African-American Democrats as mayors. During the 1970s, cities like Tallahassee, Cincinnati, Detroit, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., and New Orleans elected their first African-American mayors. Today, more than one-third of America's top 100 cities are governed by African-Americans, many of them men, women. Also today, the four largest cities in America are led by African-American mayors. This past summer, the National Urban League held its annual conference in Houston, Texas. On the second day of the conference, President and CEO Mark Morial held a fireside chat with Mayor Sylvester Turner of Houston, Mayor Eric Adams of New York City, Mayor Karen Bass of Los Angeles, California, and Mayor Brandon Johnson of Chicago, Illinois.
Ladies and gentlemen, first time on stage, these four represent experience, power, and promise. So let's give it up for these four great mayors of major American cities. Now, Mayor Turner.
Yes, sir.
You're the OG here now. Brother Turner, because of this thing called term limits, you don't have them in Chicago.
Don't even bring it up.
But Mayor Turner, I think it's helpful as you reflect on your time in office and the journey and the struggles and the travails. What wisdom and advice would you impart to our colleagues this morning?
Look, being mayor is unlike many other things. There are certain things we plan, we lay out, we come in with certain priorities, and we map them out. But it's the things you have not planned for that you have to deal with. And then there are things that happen that are not under your control, where you may have to work with, for example, the state, and the state may not want to work with you, or you have to work with the feds. But my advice is, number one, you can't do it all by yourself. This is a team effort, and so you have to have the right people around you. And you have to have people who are capable, competent, highly qualified, but people who are also dedicated to you.
Loyal.
And loyal. Because you can have the best people, and they can be smart, but if they're not loyal, it does not work.
You said something.
And so, yeah.
You mean they're smart but stupid.
And so you can't, you hold on to those that where you can check the box, but when people show you that they are not rowing in the same direction, you do what we do, and you call them in at 4 o'clock on a Friday, and you thank them for their service. But their season here has passed.
It's over. Close the door. Thank you. Let's give Mayor Turner a round of applause. He's been a great, incredible. Mayor Bass, you're 6 months in now?
Seven.
7 months in? Good to see you still smiling. Did you make the right decision by leaving a safe, comfortable seat in Congress to run for mayor of Los Angeles?
Absolutely. There's no question about it. And you know, and it wasn't that I was tired of Congress at all. I mean, I love being in Congress. I love the work, especially the work on Africa. But our folks were dying. Our folks are dying on the streets of Los Angeles. We got 46,000 people sleeping in tents. Black folk are 8% of the city, 34% of the people in tents. What I was worried about was that we were getting ready to repeat the 90s and criminalize those folks. And so I feel very, very good because we cannot repeat history. People on the street need help. They need housing. They need health care. And if I can play a role in that, wherever it is, I'm thrilled to be there and to take on the challenge.
Good. Mayor Bass of Los Angeles. Mayor Adams, and I get a chance to watch the mayor every day because I'm in New York, so I watch him, and he's brought a dynamism and a leadership. And one of the things about being mayor, you got to let everybody know you're in charge. You got to let everybody know that the buck stops at your desk. Mayor, now about what, 18 months roughly?
Yes.
In what do you? What's the biggest surprise you've encountered in that 18-month period being mayor of New York?
That's a great question. You know, and I say this over and over again, that, you know, people say being the mayor of the New York City is the second most difficult job in America. And I say, when does the hard part start? Because I know what hard is. Hard is picking cotton from sun up to sundown, yeah, delivering your baby in the field and going back. Hard is watching people jump over you in promotions when you dedicated your life. Hard is what my mother did, raising 6 children with being really abandoned and betrayed by government. Hard is being a little black child growing up, being dyslexic, then being arrested. And I like to say being rejected, but now I'm elected to be the mayor of the city of New York. So I know what hard is. I know what hard is. I wake up every day with a clear agenda, and I'm not going to be distracted. And you're not going to spend the time that I was running for office trying to degrade me, and then you want to pick my staff and tell me who to hire. I'm going to hire competent people who have my vision rowing in my direction. That is why, first time in history, I hired a black police commissioner. I hired a Hispanic to run my correctional facility. I hired the first African-American, first deputy mayor, first Indian-American to be a deputy mayor, first Filipino-American to be a deputy mayor, first Korean-American to be in charge of small business services, first African-American, first Trinidadian woman deputy mayor. I picked my team that's reflective of the city. If you want to be on my team, you have to have gone through a lot so you could help people who are going through a lot. That is how you run a city. And brother, we're running it. We're running it. You know, people are blown away with all that we inherited. Remember, January 1st, 2022, I inherited COVID. We navigated through that. Now I have 91,000 asylum seekers in my city, can't work. I have to feed, clothe, house, educate their children, and we're doing it. The bond raters who determined where you invest your money gave me a double A rating because of how I'm managing the city. You're seeing competent leadership. So the only surprise that I have is, why is it taking the national media so long to determine that black mayors can run city and they can run them right?
Amen, amen. Amen.
Now I had to get out of my seat on that one.
Amen. Yes, sir. And Mayor Johnson, when I see you, I can't help but think of the legend, Harold Washington, who was a pace setter, an inspiration for me, and one who inspired me to seek the mayor's office in New Orleans. Chicago has been longing for the spirit and the fight of Harold Washington since his untimely death in 1987. As you begin and as you think, how is Harold Washington's time a guide, an inspiration for you?
Well, thank you. That's a good question. And had I known we would have a sanctified crowd this morning...
You at the Urban League, brother.
I don't know what I was thinking. Of course, it's a sanctified crowd. but I'm grateful here. I want to thank, you know, Mayor Turner and Bass and Adams for their leadership and direction. The text messages, the calls of concern and hope have been a tremendous inspiration and has helped balance me through these first 11 weeks. You know, when you grow up and you've experienced the 80s, you know, you hear from your father, your grandfather, your uncles and aunts, you know, about a time of promise and hope. And Chicago is rich in legacy, right? And so I would be remiss if I did not acknowledge Chairman Fred, who said healthcare for all.
Yeah.
He said every child should eat before they go to school, right? That comes out of the Black Panther Party ideology and movement that was birthed on the west side of Chicago where I live, right? And when I think about, of course, the time that Dr. King spent on the west side of Chicago, and he understood the importance of the civil rights movement and the labor rights movement, and understanding that that collision had enormous potential. And he said that the rights of labor and the fight for civil rights are one and the same. The enemy of the Negro is the enemy of labor. And so then, of course, you have this ushering in of black liberation through the election of Mayor Harold Washington. And it was, of course, 40 years ago that a black mayor said sanctuary city. You know, I'm not sure if he knew that this day would come, but somehow he understood the prophetic assignment that he had. And so now, you know, when I'm moving through the streets of Chicago, the one thing that I do appreciate about black folks, especially black people, is that our hopes and aspirations are tied and linked to one another. And we are very clear that we didn't get here alone.
Amen.
And I'm glad that we serve a God that doesn't drop us off along the way.
And so, how you gonna
when
preach?
I think about, so, I mean, since y'all doing it, you know, so just as a disclaimer, I was raised in the Church of God in Christ. So, see, there's always a couple of Kojic people Kojic, here. Yeah. So,
sanctified.
This conference, this panel just got 1 hour longer.
We're gonna keep on going.
But the point, though, is that these moments don't leave us behind. These moments propel us forward. And so it's a reflection of the incredible resilience of our ancestors. And I'm glad that I get to stand on the shoulders of those who have been here before.
So I learned when I served as mayor of New Orleans from 94 to 02. When I took office, I was the first person elected in some 60 years that did not have the endorsement of the local newspaper. It was definitional. Because from the very beginning, what the local newspaper did is they put a team of reporters on me, one to play nice and one to play nasty. The one that played nice tried to make friends. The one that played nasty was looking in garbage cans. And this is important for black mayors, right? And I really want, and every city's a little bit different. You know, the way, but mayors now and elected officials now have an independent channel to people.
Right.
And I think what I'd like each of you to maybe address, Mayor Bask, we can go first, a little bit about how you think about the importance of the media and communicating with the public, because it's important for constituents to understand that it is absolutely abundantly clear that black mayors don't get treated the same. Period, time after time, example after example. No matter what you do, you could have an S on your chest. You could leap tall buildings in a single bound. But how do you think about that from a Los Angeles perspective?
Well, and you know, we can talk race, but also add in gender. I will talk about it. Because that's a dynamic as well. When I started, the whole way I was being framed was, well, is she going to be like Eric Garcetti, the previous mayor? As though I had done nothing before. I'd been in Congress, I'd been in the state legislature,
and the Speaker
of the House, but was I going to be him? But, you know, to me, I mean, my background and my root and my heart is as a community organizer. And so to me, communication means communicating on every single level. And the grassroots level is critically important. And that social media helps with that, but not enough. I mean, you have to get out and talk to people. You have to provide every kind of forum and vehicle. One of the things that we did in Congress that I plan to do in the city was telephone town halls. So I used every vehicle, in-person town halls, telephone town halls, social media. But one of the things that makes social media tough is that anybody can call themselves media and a newspaper. And so what I'm finding, and I'm sure my three colleagues up here are finding too, you'll have crazy news sources do an article that just make up stuff. And then 3 days later, quote unquote, mainstream newspapers or radio will pick it up. And then it becomes a legitimate story. But I think it's very important to be proactive. It's very important to have your own frame, but your own analysis, not just a soundbite, but an analysis about what it is that you're talking about. Because I believe that one of the most important things about communication is education. It's not just making, you know, a statement or a slogan or a soundbite, but what is it that you're trying to say that is consistent consistent with your values, and my values rooted in social and economic justice.
Thank you very much, Mayor Bass.
We'll be back with more In Black America after this message.
We're tracing the decisions that gave us the housing situation we have in Austin today. In Growth Machine, how Austin engineered its housing market. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
And now back to this episode of In Black America.
Mayor Turner, again, asking you to reflect on what's worked well when it comes to your ability to communicate to the citizens of Houston. What is it that you may know now that you wish you understood better when you started on the issue of communicating with the public?
Well, I mean, it is important as mayors that we maintain and even enhance our connection to the people that we serve. We have to become our best communicators. And what I have learned over the last 8 years as mayor, is that I have to be out there talking directly to the people. I have to be amongst them and tell what we are doing, listen to them, be accessible to them, and then hope that they too become your ambassadors. And so when they are seeing or reading stories, they themselves can say, that's not true. And I have had people, as I've gone throughout the city, after they have read something or heard something, they will say, Mayor, we know that's not true. So we have to be out there. But I'm constantly reminded what my mom said in growing up, and then she said, life is not fair, but you still have to learn Amen. To navigate through it. And so we have to be very careful that we don't become so obsessed with the negativity that we lose focus. When I first came in as mayor, the city had been facing a pension problem for some 20-some years. And right there on the front of the paper, it said, mayor must fix the pension problem now. And I said, hell, I just got here. But it was, I have to fix it. But we fixed it. And so a pension problem that was $8.2 billion when we came in is now less than $2.2 billion and going down. But what I've also discovered is that you have media that will flash a camera on the problem, but they don't give you much credit on the success. And then the ball keeps moving. You fix this, and this comes up. The last point that I will make, we just did this African trade mission to trade and investment mission to Africa. In my 8 years, you know, we have gone to Europe, we have gone to Asia, we've gone to Latin America, we have gone to the Middle East, and I've not received any negative play from the media or, quite frankly, from anybody else. The business community's gone with us, so we've gone all over the world. Now, just recently, I go to Africa. And here come the television station saying, why is the mayor going to Africa? Is this a personal junket?
Double standard.
Is this a personal Double junket? Standard. Should he be using taxpayers' money to pay for this? So you get all of that. And so sometimes I do my best not to respond. You know, you have to say, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Patience. You know,
but then on this one, I did go to social media. And what I said is that I've gone to all of these other places, no negative criticism. Now, all of a sudden, I go to Africa. Here come the negative criticisms. And what I wrote was, your comments are more reflection on you than on me. Okay, so we just have to push through it. It's going to come, and if we wait on the media or anyone else to validate what we are doing, then we have missed the point.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that, and just for the benefit of urban leaguers, I had a chance to join Vice President Harris on a trip to Ghana in March, and Africa, there are now 1.4 billion people on the African continent. It's equivalent to the population of India,
and the population of China. The average age is somewhere in the 20s, right? It's a teen, 19?
Younger, teenagers.
Very young population. So you can see what the potential in the economic future is. And you know, I say shame on the media because they didn't do any homework, no research, no understanding of the economic opportunity. And of course, here in Houston, you've got a large African community, a large African community, one of the largest in the country. So, you know, shame on the media. Mayor Johnson, and I'll come to you next, Mayor Adams. You had a vigorous, contested Chicago-style election. Y'all were duking it out to the end. And then in the 12th round, you landed one of those Ali lefts. And down went your opponent. But when you come through that, obviously sometimes the die is cast with the media and with certain segments of the community. How do you best think about navigating that as a brand new chief executive?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. And so as you talk, and as you know, Mayor Turner and Mayor Bass talked about, you know, the challenges with the media, they got an early start with me, you know. And it goes back to my time as an organizer in the city of Chicago, pushing for liberation, the hopes of those of us who are descendants of slaves. I'm a public school teacher, a middle school teacher. Usually people clap after I say that. Thank you. Thank you. You all know middle school teaching is one of the greatest positions you can ever hold. My father wanted me to become a pastor, but it's a non-union position. So I said, my best next thing to get to heaven is to teach middle school. So I know, well done, good and faithful servant. You know, they came at a brother, you know, all of the different elements that you can imagine, right, to create fear. And coming from a large family, was 10 of us, I'm the middle child. Yes, pray for me. I have issues, like most middle children. We had one bathroom, so you learn how to negotiate early in life. You know, ally with the sisters. But my older brother, who is an ancestor now, is not with us, had an addiction and died unhoused. And, you know, one of the things he would always say to me growing up, that if you're in a fight and you're ducking, you're losing that fight. He says, swing. And so in this moment, since it almost doesn't matter, you know, what I do, they're not going to like it. You know, these forces that, let's just name who these forces are. Mm-hmm. These forces still do not like the results of the Civil War. Right? I mean, these are individuals who want a rematch. So there's not much you can say to them, right? And so what I'm inspired by, though, is that the election that put me on the fifth floor was a multicultural, intergenerational movement. And 27,000 new voters voted in April that did not vote in February, all of them under the age of 34. I won by 26,532 votes. And so the youth energy is alive, and we're bringing people together. There are folks, you know, in the business community, corporate leaders, and the 80-year-old woman who has had my number since before I knew, you know, I was going to be in this position. So we're bringing people together. I'm of the mindset that there's more than enough for everyone. No one should lose at the expense of someone else winning. The city of Chicago has one of the largest economies in the world.
Mayor Brandon Johnson of Chicago, Illinois. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and Twitter, now known as X. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
Hey, but I'm going to keep it brief. Ron DeSantis is a literal supervillain. Up there with the likes of Black Jack Randall and damn Thanos. Literally out here trying to make over the squirrels. That was a Proud Family reference. I mean, take over the world. Look me in my face. This is serious, people. Ronald McDonald announced his run for president last Wednesday on Twitter, of all places. Sat down with the CEO of Twitter, Elon Musk, and the same man that got y'all dizzy over blue check subscriptions had him up there with technical difficulties, glitches, and audio crashes. You could barely hear anything they were saying. But one thing we did hear him say is that American decline is not inevitable. It is a choice, and we should choose a new direction, a path that will lead to American revitalization. And for one, we should be clear about the type of revitalization he's even talking about. And if his work in Florida serves as any pretext, then we know the decline he's talking about is the desire for critical change in our education system to embrace the analysis of racism, to accept gay people, women's rights, trans people, and the desire for stricter gun laws. He's implemented the infamous Don't Say Gay law, HB 1521, which restricts public access to transgender people, SB 254, which bans gender-affirming care for the youth, HB 1069, that bans the correct pronoun usage for trans students, HB 1438, which bans drag shows, in the HB 225, an anti-trans sports bill. And if you wanted to peacefully protest any of these undoubtedly fascist policies, well, he's banned that too. And before long, they're gonna be trying to arrest people like me for sedition. So I'm not kidding when I say this. It's giving Hitler. Revitalization is exactly the same language he was giving at the top of his career as this messianic leader before the nationalism, elitism, and fascism that somehow led to Jewish people being murdered in internment camps right before our eyes. And if we want to take that full circle, Hitler's Aryan race philosophy was informed by the codified racism of early Jim Crow. And Jim Crow is also the system that informs the grand design that DeSantis has been employing all along, the Southern strategy. A throwback, if you will. Nixon did it, Reagan did it, Trump did it, and now we're sitting here horrified looking at the prospect of DeSantis making it into office. The Southern strategy was first employed by Kevin Phillips, Richard Nixon's political strategist. The goal of the Southern strategy was essentially to lean into the racism that already existed in the South, to lure white racist Democrats out of the Democratic Party and over on down to the GOP. They did not coin this term, but they certainly took it and ran with it. When discussing the outcome of the Voting Rights Act of 1964, the one that allowed black people to register to vote unencumbered, Kevin said, the more Negroes that register as Democrats in the South, the sooner the Negrophobe whites will quit the Democrats and become Republicans. They have no shame! And while Nixon's strategy may have resulted in an over-obsession with communism, Reagan's may have resulted in the end of free college, a trampled economy, and negotiation with terrorists, Trump's may have resulted in a proliferation of the Proud Boys, but DeSantis poses danger to the lives of Americans even more so because he's threatening our very being. And here's the thing, Ron DeSantis done upped the ante, elevated the Southern strategy, and got y'all so hyped up on his anti-black, anti-woman, anti-queer pro-gun platform, and guess what? He probably don't even believe in it. He can't possibly. He's too smart and too successful a politician to be limited by flat-out ignorance. But guess what? Y'all not. And there it is. We saw it with Tucker Carlson. These people only believe in this shit to the extent that they know that you believe in it and are so impressed by it that you'll carry y'all dumbasses down to the courthouses and use it as the only information you use to vote with. And as DeSantis puts it, Florida is where woke goes to die. And unfortunately, he has now tried to rope Asians in on his anti-woke narrative while literally banning critical race theory and books about black people left and right, like his Fahrenheit 451, the man is mandating that AAPI history be taught in Florida schools. And I'm not saying that it shouldn't be. I'm just saying he don't like y'all neither. He using y'all just like the white races in an attempt to garner Asian support against the interests of black people. Beyond that, this move also serves as a message to the rest of the Americans that might vote for him that doubles down on the mono-minority myth, which is another conversation altogether. It's crazy how many of y'all don't like us just because white people set you up to hate us, no matter how down for y'all we've been historically. And listen, I know Joe just took a tumble, and I really am not interested in getting up here to beg y'all to vote again. And I know it seems like this show is about politics, and you're not wrong, but you are mistaken. This show was developed to engage the public in critical conversation about identity politics. That means you, all the pieces that make up your identity and who you are. And unfortunately, policy that should be focused on the economy, actual criminality, and how this country actually runs itself is actually hinged on you. The government of a country that had to codify slavery and misogyny into law to justify it will always have its priorities conflated with human rights. And if we don't do something and show up, they will do their best to kill us and call it legal. So Ron DeSanctimonious is right. And we can try to laugh to keep from crying, but it's literally scary out here.
We begin tonight with breaking news. A potentially explosive development in Jack Smith's federal case against Donald Trump and his attempt to overturn the 2020 election. ABC News is reporting that Mark Meadows, Trump's White House chief of staff, was granted immunity by the special counsel in exchange for his testimony under oath before a grand jury. ABC reports that according to sources familiar with the matter, Meadows has spoken with Smith's team at least three times this year and reportedly told them that he had warned the former president about his election lies. ABC reports, quote, the sources said Meadows informed Smith's team that he repeatedly told Trump in the weeks after the 2020 presidential election that the allegations of significant voting fraud coming to them were baseless, a striking break from Trump's prolific rhetoric regarding the election. According to the sources, Meadows also told the federal investigators that Trump was being dishonest with the public when he first claimed to have won the election only hours after polls closed on November 3rd, 2020, before final results were even in. Obviously, we didn't win, a source quoted Meadows as telling Smith's team in hindsight. NBC News has not confirmed this reporting, but this testimony from Meadows, one of the people closest to Trump at the time, would be critical evidence in Smith's case and his ability to establish proof beyond a doubt that Trump knew he lost and tried to overturn a Democratic election anyway. I'm joined now by Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff of California. This seems to me, Congressman Schiff, to be the big one, because Mark Meadows was the closest person to Trump and in helping him overturn the election. Your take on this news from ABC?
Well, I think it is very big news. In a way, it's not surprising. People never expected Mark Meadows to be a Steve Bannon, you know, gleefully riding into jail on behalf of Donald Trump. That is not Mark Meadows. He never signed up to go to jail. He was, you know, carrying out Donald Trump's dirty work every day. But self-preservation has kicked in, and it appears that he is cooperating. You know, the challenge with him is he's written a book which was touting all the Trump lies. He's told a lot of the Trump lies himself, so he is not a perfect witness by any means. But nevertheless, you know, having him be able to confirm conversations, having him be able to share firsthand information about what Donald Trump knew and saw, any acknowledgement of his loss of the election privately while Trump was out publicly telling the big lie, all of that is still going to be very useful for prosecutors.
It is. You mentioned the book, and he is now allegedly, at least according to ABC's reporting, admitted that he doesn't even believe the stuff in his book. In terms of, you know, his usefulness to prosecutors, you did mention the book. The fact that he is now saying that he published a book, presumably took an advance and payment from the publisher, and now says and is telling investigators he doesn't even believe what's in the book. How does that taint or impact him as a witness?
It'll certainly impact his credibility. You can imagine if he were called as a witness by Jack Smith to testify about what Trump did and said, he would be impeached with his own words in his book, which is why you're going to need corroboration for what Meadows is saying, other means of proof. Still useful, still important. Prosecutors will make the case, as they often do in organized crime cases, that crooks surround themselves with other crooks. And you're going to have to rely on, you know, imperfect witnesses to tell the story. But, you know, for someone that close to Trump, in all the meetings, to essentially have flipped and be willing to talk is significant. I do think more valuable witnesses are people like Cipollone, the White House counsel, and others that don't have quite as strong a taint as Mark Meadows. But nevertheless, this is an important development. You add to it these other lawyers surrounding Trump, the Sidney Powells, the Jenna Ellises, the Chesbros, and others. And, you know, the walls start closing in on Donald Trump.
Yeah, indeed. And, of course, Jenna Ellis now also taking a plea. Let me let you respond to that, because now you do have somebody who was in supposedly this high-level team of the strike force, they called themselves. Now, two out of the three of the members of this supposed strike force, Sidney Powell and Jenna Ellis, have pleaded guilty. For Donald Trump, this does seem pretty dire.
It does. You know, these are basically, I think they were referred to by you know, the White House counsel lawyers as the clown car lawyers. You know, the team, there was Team Normal and then there was Team Clown Car. These were members of the clown car along with Giuliani. I think both Donald Trump needs to be worried about them providing state's evidence, but also Rudy Giuliani needs to be concerned. These were a couple of his right-hand people. Yeah. And, you know, it's all cumulative. You can use them to corroborate documentary evidence. You can use them to set the time and place of other meetings. They'll provide insights you can't get from others. So it's just adding to the body of evidence. And for those who wondered, why is the Fulton County DA indicting 19 people in the same indictment? You can't possibly try a case with 19 people. Well, you can't. She doesn't have to anymore. Every day, every week, more people are pleading guilty, and they're going to be taken out of the trial and be added to the stable of witnesses.
Absolutely. Let me read a little bit of this reporting, ABC, on whether Trump acknowledged any loss. This is important to his defense. While speaking with investigators, Meadows was specifically asked if Trump ever acknowledged him that he lost the election. Meadows told investigators he never heard Trump say that, according to sources. What do you make of that?
Well, I think, you know, in that reporting as well, there is an acknowledgement by Trump when the Supreme Court rules against him. Well, that's it. I'm done. But he wasn't done. And he went on to challenge the election in other ways. And this is what you get with Mark Meadows. You're going to get kind of a little bit on this side, a little bit on that side. That is, you know, sort of how he conducted affairs in the White House, telling each different group that appeared what they wanted to hear. And I think we're seeing more of this in the reporting about his testimony before the grand jury. But it's very characteristic of who he is. And that is, you know, quite chameleon-like, which does make him challenging as a witness, not without value, potentially with significant value, but certainly not problem-free either.
As you just mentioned, per the ABC, when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on December 11, 2020, denying the final court challenge, Trump told Meadows something to the effect of, that's it, that's the end. There's also this reporting from ABC that Meadows has allegedly told investigators that Trump seemed to grow increasingly concerned as he learned about what was transpiring at the Capitol and was visibly shaken when he heard that someone had been shot there. Your thoughts on that?
Well, that's a new insight that we haven't heard. We have certainly seen and heard testimony about how cavalierly he was watching these events unfold in the dining room, you know, calmly taking this in on the television while people kept coming in and pleading with him to do something. And, you know, some of the most powerful testimony was that when Meadows was being pushed to get the president to do something, to call it off, there was the response, well, you know, you've heard what he said, essentially words to the effect of he thinks Pence deserves it. And so being able to get Meadows on the record, we have, you know, this conversation secondhand from others, being able to ask Meadows about that conversation and others will be really useful to prosecutors.
Let me play Cassidy Hutchinson, who was just on with my colleague Ari Melber just a little while ago. This is what she had to say and her initial reaction to Meadows' apparent cooperation.
In my experience, Mark was sort of all over the board in some ways. You know, he would privately admit to me sometimes that the election, that we had lost the election, or sometimes he would privately admit to me that Trump had said that we had lost the election. But Mark also was a key player in bringing in characters like Sidney Powell and like Jenna Ellis. In my experience, he would at times acknowledge what I have read in the ABC report.
I mean, the all over the place, you know, sort of status of Mark Meadows even came out in the January 6th hearings where he's sort of catatonic when the violence is happening and says, as you said, you know, he doesn't want to do anything. Trump doesn't want to do anything and that he thought Pence deserved it. Cassidy Hutchinson also says in her new book that Mark Meadows burned so many papers after the 2020 election that it left his office smoky and even prompted his wife to complain that his suits smelled like a bonfire. That to me sounds incredibly damning. Getting an immunity deal when you might have been burning evidence seems odd to me. Do you think that at some point he will be prosecuted either by Georgia or by someone else?
You know, I really can't say. I really don't know whether
he is
will,
in Georgia. Sorry,
you know, sort of chameleon-like evade prosecution by cutting deals. That testimony from Cassidy, you know, as the former chair of the Intel Committee, was alarming to me at the time. It's alarming to me today. We were really never able to get to the bottom of what he was destroying. And I would hope that as a part of his cooperation, we get new insights on that. He might, you know, have, you know, important value, for example, in the Mar-a-Lago documents case. He might be able to shed light on how some of those documents got there, his conversations with the president, or warnings that were made to him and the president. But for the sake of national security, I hope that any deal would also require him to be truthful about that. Final, you know, point on that is, would it make sense to have a deal with somebody involved in that kind of conduct? Really depends on the value of their testimony. And presumably, if Smith gave Meadows immunity, it was either because it would be difficult to prosecute him or because the value of what he was getting was so significant, it outweighed the benefit of bringing him to justice.
Yeah, and of course, I misspoke. Of course, he is already being prosecuted in Georgia, so he is on the hook for that. Congressman Adam Schiff, thank you very much.
A new Supreme Court term is underway. The justices are hearing arguments in several cases that could impact everything from our use of social media to our protections as consumers. It's worth noting this follows a term in which the court made decisions that overturned precedent, like with the Dobbs decision repealing Roe v. Wade. Rick Pildes is a constitutional law professor at New York University School of Law. It's so nice to have you with us.
Very glad to be with you, Soledad.
Thank you. All right, let's dive in with the first case involving the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. So at the heart of it is how it's funded. Why does that matter?
The Constitution says that all money out of the Treasury has to be appropriated by Congress. So when this bureau was set up, which was Elizabeth Warren's idea after the financial crisis, she wanted this to be as independent of the political process as possible. Congress passed a statute with the Federal Reserve being the entity that provides money to this bureau. And the challenge now is that bureaus or agencies can't be funded in this way. The money has to come kind of directly through congressional appropriations. And if this challenge is upheld, it would mean that a lot of federal agencies, particularly ones in the financial area, would be potentially unconstitutional, including the Federal Reserve itself.
Well, let's say they say, in fact, okay, Congress has to fund you. The real worry is politicizing that bureau.
Absolutely. The bureau's returned something like $17 billion in money to consumers over its lifetime, based on findings of fraud or manipulation and the like. But if Congress has to fund this every year and make a decision about it, the bureau is absolutely at risk because of the Republican resistance to this bureau.
Okay, let's talk about this social media case that's before the court. Spell out, in layman's terms, what it's about.
So this is the most important case involving social media that the Supreme Court has heard. It involves the basic question of whether government can regulate the platforms or whether the platforms themselves have First Amendment rights that protect them from government regulation.
You've said it's sort of like railroads or utilities.
That's a great way to put it. So the states of Florida and Texas say, you're like a railroad, you're a monopoly, you're a common carrier. And common carriers traditionally have had obligations to serve everybody on equal terms. The platforms say, no, we're engaged, when we do content moderation, we're engaged in decisions like newspapers or other editors. And so the First Amendment protects us when we make these decisions.
What potentially are the big implications here?
Well, there are implications all over the place. So for the election process, which is what I study in particular, the platforms have been very active, they were in 2020, in taking down misinformation or disinformation about the election. It's unclear under these laws that Texas and Florida have passed, you know, whether the platforms would continue to be able to do that. There's scientific information, like about vaccines. The platforms took down wrong information about the vaccines. Will they be able to continue to do that with other issues that are in the science realms? It's incredibly broad what's at stake in these cases.
There's a Second Amendment case before the court, which is basically, can somebody who has a domestic violence restraining order against them actually own a gun?
What's going on here is the Supreme Court changed the doctrine in this area in a dramatic way a year ago, in this case called Bruin. And what the court said then is, the only regulations of guns that are permitted are ones that are consistent with history and tradition in the United States. Now, domestic restraining orders never existed until the 1970s.
Is there a giant implication about gun rights generally,
yes,
as this case goes through?
This is going to be the first time the court gives more content on how this new standard about the role of history and tradition applies to various kinds of gun regulations.
Rick Pildes is at NYU School of Law. Thank you for talking with me. Appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
Brian Lekanich says he never knew how he might be harmed when he allowed Chevron to build a massive fracking operation on his Washington County farm. His son Ryan was covered with sores after taking a bath. Brian became sick and eventually developed brain tumors and kidney failure.
It's destroyed all my hopes and dreams of my farm, my life with my children. It's been rough. I can't go to a spigot and turn on water and drink it. I have to worry about every time my son takes a shower if he's going to get blisters. We shouldn't have to live that way in today's society.
He says he was forced to bottle his drinking and bathing water in a nearby spring. The lawsuit says Brian's water contained high amounts of PFAS, known as forever chemicals. Chevron and EQT say repeated tests found no evidence that fracking caused those chemicals to get into his water. Outside the courthouse, activists rallied to support the Lekanich family. Inside court, Chevron's lawyer argued that its parent company should not be named in the lawsuit. The attorney for Lekanich disagrees.
It's our view that this is the company and these are the people who are directing these operations that are harming people and that are damaging the environment. So that corporation and those individuals should be held to account.
Chevron and EQT are also trying to block Brian Lekanich from using a statewide grand jury report on fracking as part of their lawsuit. Now, after today's hearing, I tried to talk to an attorney for Chevron and EQT, but she declined to comment. In court, she said today's hearing was not the time or the place to address substantive issues in the lawsuit.
I'm Mark Lamont Hill, and this is a word about why Black Americans should support Palestinian liberation. I first became interested in the Middle East when I became interested in Malcolm X. I read Malcolm's story, and when I saw that Malcolm in 1959 and again in 1964 had made these trips to Africa and also to the Middle East, I became interested in what Malcolm was interested in, which was thinking about Black freedom on a global scale. I then went back to graduate school after my PhD to pursue another degree in Middle East studies. I wanted to know what it meant to be Black in Jordan or Iran or Egypt or Palestine. Since the end of the 19th century, there has been a growing battle over the area that is now known as Israel and Palestine. Waves of Jewish immigration into the region, combined with tensions over land, over employment, over law, over what the state would look like, have gotten more and more and more intense over this period of time. Over decades, we saw greater and greater emphasis on pushing Palestinians off of the land, taking away land rights, taking away employment opportunities, and you saw resistance, you saw struggle, you saw battles, and at the same time, you also have increased anti-Semitism, you have increased pressure around the globe, which is compounded once you get to the 1930s and 1940s, because you now have this thing called World War II. Of course, you have the Holocaust. You have all these things that are legitimizing a very real need to find a safe haven for Jewish people. The question was, how do we provide a safe haven for Jewish people and still honor the fact that there are indigenous Palestinians on this land who have a right to be here? And so for that reason, we see a struggle over the region and over that particular slice of land that continues until today. To call it a settler colonial project is not to deny the legitimacy of Judaism or of Jewish people in the region. Settler colonialism is not just controlling the territory and the land, but it's actually moving onto that land and replacing the indigenous people of the land. Israeli settler colonialism is more complicated than other places. There is a long-standing and legitimate Jewish presence in Israel and in historic Palestine. And what we've seen since 1882, which is the beginning of the first major immigration, is not just a wave of people coming in, but a very organized and systematic attempt to push Palestinians out. I don't like to make apples to apples comparisons between what Palestinians are going through and what Black people are going through. I don't want people to feel like the struggles have to be the same to be worth the investment in them. That said,
There's a long tradition of black folk who have stood up and spoken out against the occupation of Palestine and spoken for the liberation and self-determination of the Palestinian people. Huey P. Newton and the Black Panthers believed in the struggle of the Palestinian people and showed solidarity. So you got from Malcolm, SNCC, the Panthers, Angela Davis, June Jordan, a black person standing with Palestine ain't new. There are people in the United States who say, look, black folk are catching enough hell here. We should put our 100% attention on that. And I ain't mad at people that say that. I don't agree, but I understand the impulse to say, look, cops are shooting us, the economy is collapsing, schools are broken. How can I think about someone in Palestine? We should care about the Palestinian freedom struggle first because they're human beings. And as African people, we don't have the luxury of choosing who we're going to be allied with. We have to side with all principled, humanistic freedom struggles. I don't care where they are. We can't get free unless everybody's free. That's not just some lefty cliche. That's a fact. The networks of power, the structures of power that oppress people in one country are connected to the structures that oppress people in this country. So for black folk to get free, everybody needs to be free.
We have an opportunity to not just offer solidarity in words, but to commit to political action, grassroots action, local action, and international action that will give us what justice requires. And that is a free Palestine from the river to the sea.
When I said free Palestine from the river to the sea, I was making a call for justice for Palestinian people who live inside the state of Israel, for those Palestinian people who are in the West Bank, and for those who are in Gaza. There are different forms of oppression and violence and occupation happening in each of those areas. And I was saying, I don't want to just talk about one of those areas. I want to talk about all those areas. And my ultimate vision is a single democratic state, one person, one vote, secular, for everybody. No Jew should be pushed out. No Jew should be harmed. No Palestinian should be pushed out. No Palestinian should be harmed. For me, this is the vision. That means that the land should be free from the river to the sea. That was the argument. Some people said, oh, but Hamas says from the river to the sea. And if Hamas says it, then you must be supporting Hamas and you must be supporting a project of eliminating Jews from the area. Let me be very clear. At no point was I calling for harm to Jewish people, violence against Jewish people, for pushing Jewish people out of the land. None of that is what I'm calling for. None of that is what I believe in. We must fight for and protect Jewish brothers and sisters at all costs. Jews have a right to self-determination, to freedom, to justice, to safety, to protection, to dignity. They do. But so do Palestinians. I'm calling for Palestinian self-determination and freedom. I'm calling for the liberation of Palestinian people. And if Israel were occupied, I'd be calling for the same thing. If Jews were under attack in Israel the way Palestinians are, I'd be calling for that. The same way I do for Jews who are under attack all around the world, in Europe, in the United States, in the Middle East. We have to protect Jewish people, but it can't be the only conversation we have. We have to be able to talk about protecting Jewish people and protecting Palestinian people and protecting vulnerable people around the world. And if we can do that, now we got to...
You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
I'm always hard put to recall them all, but the release of all political prisoners, the ending of the state of emergency, the repeal of the apartheid legislation on the books in the country, the unbanning of the anti-apartheid groups in the country. Now, some of the conditions have arguably been met, some have been only partially met, and some have not been met at all. The organizations have been unbanned. The state of emergency has been lifted in part, but one could suggest that even if it were lifted all across the country, the laws that give it muscle still remain very much in place. In South Africa, it doesn't matter whether or not you have a state of emergency or not. That's just a measure of art. The law is very much there to give the police virtually the same power this state of emergency notwithstanding.
Mr. Randall Robinson, Executive Director of TransAfrica, the lobby group for Africa and the Caribbean. With a mandate from the Congressional Black Caucus back in 1977, Randall Robinson formed the organization with only 2 staff persons. Currently, the organization has 12 staff persons and 1/10 of the present operating budget of $700,000. TransAfrica does not have the kind of clout or the financial support of that of an American Jewish lobby that Israel has developed. But under the leadership of Randall Robinson, TransAfrica is asserting itself as an institutional expression and extension of Pan-Africanist work started by George Padmore, C.L.R. James, W.E.B. Du Bois, Marcus Garvey, and Paul Robeson. I'm John L. Hansen, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. This week, TransAfrica with Randall Robinson in Black America.
There is no question that the Bush administration and President Bush himself want to lift these sanctions. And so they will attempt to interpret fulfillment of the conditions in a way that will allow them to do just that. I think several mistakes have been made. One was the invitation to Mr. de Klerk to visit the United States.
What was your reaction?
Oh, we're very much opposed to that. And that's not to suggest that I'm opposed to full diplomatic exchange and discussion. I think our Secretary of State should see Pete Bolton. I think members of Congress should go there. Members of our Parliament should come here. But the Oval Office is a special place that carries a different imprimatur of American support and embrace. There are many people in the world with whom we have a diplomatic exchange we don't invite to the Oval Office. Yasser Arafat hasn't been there and won't be coming. Fidel Castro hasn't been there and won't be coming. The same is true for many, many others, through Muammar Gaddafi. And I don't suppose Saddam Hussein will cross that threshold anytime in the future. The fact is that South Africa, aside from image, very much the same way Mr. Gorbachev has done in the Soviet Union, which is proving not to be authentic, aside from image, has not changed very much in South Africa. The apartheid law is still very much on the book. Blacks cannot vote. The Group Areas Act is still in place. The Separate Amenities Act, the Internal Security Act, the Land Acts, all of these pillars of the apartheid system are still very much in place. And he essentially has done 2 things, largely of public relations value, released Nelson Mandela, and unbanned the ANC so that there's above-ground discussion.
On Thanksgiving Eve in 1984, Randall Robinson and 3 others entered the South African Embassy in Washington, D.C., and politely announced they would not leave the embassy until apartheid was abolished. Their arrest helped put apartheid on America's agenda. Sanctions were implemented, South Africans suffered, and 6 years later, Nelson Mandela was released from a South African prison. Recently, Randall Robinson brought his broad-based knowledge on South African and Caribbean affairs to the University of Texas at Austin during Black History Month celebrations. Before his presentation, this reporter sat down with this gentle, persuasive person to discuss his goals and objectives as executive director of TransAfrica.
It's difficult to get Americans to understand the problems that we faced are not peculiar to African Americans. We, in large part, live in a country of people who are woefully ignorant about foreign affairs in general. And so education is a major part of our responsibility. Unless people know about issues, you can't expect them to be concerned about those issues. But we've had some conspicuous success. I mean, we have sanctions now against South Africa because of the leadership of African Americans and because of the vigorous role that African Americans played in the campaign and drive for sanctions in Washington. So I think there is a real interest. There's still some issues we need to know a lot more about. Issues of U.S. Economic assistance to African countries, refugee policy, trade policy, all of those less than exciting economic issues that are tremendously important to countries attempting to develop their economies, but issues about which Americans in the main know very little. And it's not just a problem on the African issues, it's global. And in large part, that's why we've launched headlong into a war that I think we will live to regret in the Gulf now, because most Americans don't understand anything about the Arab world or the consequences that we will have to face before this war is over and long after it's concluded.
Has the mood Americans have towards Africa changed since the formation of Trans-Africa in 1977?
Well, I think we've come a long way from Tarzan.
Okay.
But we have still a very long way to go. I think Americans are less indelibly